This is a Dog Guide Handlers Australia audio presentation.
Thanks everybody. Thanks for the great morning tea. Just for those of you that are not aware, the hotel staff here have gone above and beyond to make us feel welcome. There is a big welcome, tactile welcome sign outside with some dog treats for all of the dogs. So they've really gone above and beyond, so we thank them for that. So my name is Rowena Dowling. I'm currently on the committee of Dog Guide Handlers Australia. This is our second session, and it's titled The Past, Present and Future of Dog Guide Mobility. It'll be in three sessions, so looking at firstly the past, then the present and the future. So to talk about the past, we have Greg Manson, who's currently Treasurer of DJHA, who has done some research on some very significant people in the history of dog guide mobility in Australia. And this is our tribute to those people. He'll just be sharing a brief profile of four people that would be known to many of the people in this room who have had dog guides for a very long time. And after the session today, those tributes will be put up on the DGHA website as a permanent memorial to those people. And we will be adding to that over time, and that's our recognition of like our wall of fame, I guess, for people that have been influential in the dog guide industry. And, you know, we will definitely see it grow over the year. There's so many people out there that are amazing and have made an amazing contribution. And there's many more that, you know, gaining experience and will be, you know, amazing on our wall of fame in the next 10 to 20 years. So thank you, Greg.
Thanks, Rowena. Just doing this a little bit informally, I might be doing the audio as well, so I'm just going to be speaking from the back of the room for those who can't see. This was a fascinating thing to read, the history of how dog guides came to Australia. For those who are Douglas Adams fans, it's amazing the interconnectivity of all these people and how it sort of at the beginning they were all sort of involved with each other and how it sort of spread out and became the two schools, Guide Dogs Australia and Seeing Eye Dogs, starting from humble beginnings back in Perth. But back to the beginning, in the early 50s, after the war, there was a school set up to assist lots of soldiers who were blind during the war to be able to get out, navigate, and become independent again under their own steam. That was set up in England. Later moved to a place called Leamington Spa, and it was actually probably quite a military-run organisation, just reading through the history, because there was a lot of soldiers that were involved, and in fact the guy who was in charge of that particular unit there had come out of the war. He was in the Cossacks, so probably quite regimented. Anyway, the reason I mention that is because it must have been very difficult. There was a young girl, and she's described as being red-headed and small and very petite. She wanted to be a guide dog instructor. She loved dogs. Wanted to be a guide dog instructor. So she approached the school and asked whether she could become a guide dog instructor. She said, no, you can't, because you're a woman. Back in the day. She was, you know, quite a bit upset about that, but kept on trying, kept on going back. So I'd like to be a guide dog instructor. Eventually they said yes. And it was only a couple of years later that she was managing another unit that sort of started up there. Her name was Becky Gritch. So she had become a guide dog instructor. At the same time, a young guy at the time, in Perth, Western Australia, a guy named Arnold Cook, was going through university at the University of Western Australia through doing economics. Passed that with honours, and from that, he got a scholarship to go to England to finish his studies or to increase his knowledge around his studies. So he went over to England, and while he was there doing his studies, he came across this school that was training dogs to assist people who were blind. So he approached the school and was happy, was glad, was successful in being partnered with a dog. So he finished his studies, brought that dog back to Western Australia. So that was the first dog that was trained for the blind in Australia. So he went through the usual stuff that you would go, well not the usual stuff, the stuff that you would go through. Dog being for the blind in the early 50s, and getting around the city and all the, well, not really suspicion, but all the barriers that there would be around that. By sheer coincidence, Betty Bridge parents immigrated to New Zealand. And no one must have been in contact with Betty and heard that she was going to visit her parents in New Zealand and asked whether she might stop off in Fremantle on the way past, which she did. And she was met at Fremantle by Arnold Cook and some other people who had an idea of starting a training unit in Perth for training guide dogs, people who were blind. Betty was interested in that, but she did continue her journey off to see her parents. After she'd done that from New Zealand, she came back and dropped back in and then did start training dogs. She was the first guide dog trainer in Australia to start training dogs. So it was quite a new thing. They didn't have much money. They managed through some donations to get about £100 in the bank. From that £100, they bought two old tram carriages that they converted into the guide dog school. It cost about £80 at the time. And this was in Shenton Park. Shenton Park's probably just a couple of kilometres just outside the CBD of Perth, near Subiaco and Claremont and those sort of places. Also very much involved, the reason they were able to build this with very little money, was the Apex Club of Claremont, the Rotary Club of Fremantle. Apex Club of Claremont comes up quite a lot throughout the whole thing. They did a lot of great work for many, many, many years in doing, work that wasn't paid for, or bringing their members in to do renovations or whatever needed to be done. So there you had the start of a school, of the first school to train guide dogs in WA. And we'll get to seeing guide dogs a bit later on. So they had this training centre there, that they were building up. They had puppy walking programs in place. They put all that in place. They had fundraising going on, and back then I was reading that one of their street appeals, they got £1,300. Now that is a huge amount of money back in those days. For blind citizens WA, we do that in dollars these days. $1,300. And they ended their pounds, so that was a good amount of money to have in their kit. And they needed it because they had to, and not only had the dogs, they had to feed the dogs. They were also housing potential students. And the way they used to do that was that, because they weren't just training people in WA, the first couple were people from WA, and the first one was Elsie Mead. She was the first person in Australia who trained with a guide dog. That's in Australia. Arnold Cook brought his dog with him from England. And they also had people come from outside of WA. The first person coming from Mr. Adams, I think it was, from Inverell in New South Wales, was flown in, accommodated, trained with a dog, and sat back. And we were talking to some of the trainers, some people earlier on today about, we come over from Perth and it takes 3.5 hours and 5 hours to get back, and how shocking that is, And now, just reading, and I was mentioning, just reading the history. Firstly, you had Betty, who came from England by ship, would have taken months, went around, dropped into New Zealand on the way and then came back. That would have been a couple of years out of her life, easily. And then people flying I'm in Burrell, and it wouldn't have been a direct flight from Inverell to Perth, I dare say. It would have been Inverell to Sydney, and then Sydney probably to Adelaide, and then Adelaide to Perth, because the place didn't have the reach that they have these days. So he was the first one. After that, there was a couple of people from Victoria who applied for dogs and were accepted, and they were flown over to Western Australia. One of those was Bill Gratian. So she went over to Perth, got trained up, went back to Victoria, and that's how things went for a while in the early 50s and into the early 60s. So a lot of volunteer work, a lot of raising of money. Only the one trainer at that stage in Betty Bridge. And during that period, or even prior to that, there had been an attempt to start up a school in Victoria. But for one reason or another, it didn't quite get off the ground. But work was still continuing around that. And the committee in Perth encouraged the Victorian groups, or all states really, to see if they could get funds to start up a guide dog school in their particular state. So nothing really happened in that 10 years in the other states, but in the late 50s, there was some momentum in Victoria, and a plot of land was donated to the then sort of establishing guide dogs of Victoria at that stage. Guide dog Victoria would have been in the late 50s. Then in the early 60s, there was an incorporated body called Guide Dogs Australia, might not have been the Guide Dogs Australia Association, something like that. So the states could put their money together. And as I said, there was a plot of land donated by the Victorian government in Kew. And then some money was raised. And the money was raised. There was a famous back then, probably still is, probably no, he's not famous now because he's dead. But it was alive back then. Jack Davies. There's probably very few people in this room, there's a few people in the room that know the name, but don't remember either. I think I might have got a vague recollection of seeing him on TV, but he was a very popular. He was your anywhere guy back in the day. So they put his name to an appeal to raise money to build the Guide Dog Centre, or to start Guide Dogs in Victoria. And it was the Guide Dogs Victoria Jack Davies Memorial or something similar to that. So they raised quite a bit of money and were able to start to build a school there. Because there was talk from the trainers and so forth, but it was very difficult, obviously, back in those days, to fly people over to train them up and then fly them back again. The population, obviously, was up and down the east coast of Australia, and it was seen that to make it a successful project to keep guide dogs in Australia and making them available for the most number of people, that having a place in the eastern coast was going to be the way to go. And from that, be able to build that with the knowledge that was gained in the 10 years that it was in WA. They were also taking people from New Zealand as well, so there was quite a bit going on from New Zealand to Perth, people then trained up and then going back to New Zealand. So that's sort of the basis of it, of where that was. And just to fit in that, where, seeing night dogs came. Phyllis Gratian had got her dog. Obviously went back to Victoria. She was one of the early people, so it was in the early 50s. Went back to Victoria. Probably, and I'm assuming some reading between the lines here with a few things, but the dog would probably get close to retirement. She was involved in the guide dogs of Victoria for a while, and then for whatever reason, because the history I was reading is sort of a little bit, well, it's not too heavy, but they actually go through some of the actual meeting, what happened at each meeting, which is quite interesting. Meetings were very formal back in those days. Lots of official letters being written backwards and forwards before you can do anything. Anyway, during that time, there must have been some sort of fallout or differing of opinions, And Phyllis Gratian went her own way and started an association called Guide Dog Owners and Friends Association. That went for about 6 months. We didn't go, we didn't finish. It basically changed to Lady Nell Seeing Eye Dogs. So it started their own school with a guide dog trainer. There's some controversy around the fact that the trainer that Phyllis was using weren't particularly qualified. but I, you know, you can see, as again, reading between the lines, that obviously Phyllis was an end user and probably had a lot of great peer support. Whereas, you know, the stuff that I was reading, a lot of the other schools were pretty much governed by lawyers and accountants, all with, you know, good big hearts and great intentions, but possibly didn't really quite know, you know, the end user's experience. And as I don't know this, there is a book that Phyllis wrote, I haven't read it yet, but I can imagine that might have been the way. So she started Lady Nell Seeing Eye Dogs, and that's where that came from. You know, Seeing Eye Dogs grew from there. So we've got these two great schools. So going back to Western Australia in the late 60s, there was a guide dog trainer over in England called Eric Hatchley. Got his qualifications in England, and he was persuaded to come out and help Betty Bridge. The need was expanding, more dogs, more people, more trainers were needed. So he came out from England and did some great work in Perth, obviously, for a while. And then he must have moved over to Victoria. He's one of the people we're going to put up on this page on the website. There's many people that can go up there, but we've got to start with a few. So Phyllis is going to be one of those. Eric is going to be one of those. Lee Garwood is going to be one of those. I didn't find much on the web around Lee's early years, but we certainly do know that Lee was overseeing and managing Seeing Eye Dogs when the new centre was being built. And I don't know if anybody had been there, but it's a fantastic centre and resource to be able to train dogs with escalators and all sorts of great stuff. So great feather in the cap for Australia to be able to train those dogs. And the other person I wanted to mention is Tom Blair. Tom Blair was in 1961. Did his guide dog training. He was actually the first, he was a guide dog cadet. I think during the Phyllis Gratian days, when there was this controversy about qualified and unqualified trainers, they started this group called Trainee Cadets. And Tom Blair was a trainee cadet in 1961. So he went through his training, did lots of training, and he, according to what I was reading, was the first actual properly qualified guide dog trainer, Australian, in Australia. And Tom, unfortunately we lost Tom early this year, but Tom not only did some great work in WA, in Victoria, and in remote South Australia, we're talking remote, and it really was remote back then. Can only imagine his experience in driving into these places and having to stay there overnight, I suppose, most of the time. But anyway, Tom did a lot of great work also, not only within Australia, but in Indonesia, in South Africa, in Africa. He was a guide dog trainer. He would train guide dog trainers in those countries to be self-sustaining, or self-sufficient. And did that for many years, and met Tom late last year, and he was still working, and he must have been in his 80s then. We're moving pretty much close to his 80s. Might have just had a birthday, actually. I think that's probably why we got together. But the only reason I mentioned Tom a bit, because I actually from WA, I didn't know him, it's not to say that he is over and above any of these other people that we're honouring as well. Just happened to know Tom. Didn't know Eric. I wouldn't have been old enough. I was only just born when Tom started his cadetship, actually. So that's where a lot of these people that we're putting up on our website have sort of come from, and listening to the history and how it was put together, and the great passion shown by a lot of people putting in a lot of hours to get these two, where we are today with these two schools up and running. So our to get to the point that I was going to get to, so what we're going to do on the website, we're starting a page, don't know what we're going to call it yet, but call it the Wall of Honour, a page of honour, and we're going to be putting up some of these great people that have pioneered, dog guide training here in Australia. And they're the first four, as I say, is Philip Gratian, Eric Hatchley, Tom Blair, and Philip. Did I say Philip Gratian? Lee Garwood. They're the first people that are going to be up on our page of honour. I'll see if I can get hold of some of the stuff out of Phyllis's book. I don't think Tom helps. Unfortunately, that Tom I think was writing a book. So I might see if we can get hold of some of that, but Tom's also had some great memorabilia, and I believe that's somewhere in New South Wales. At the moment, I think Paul, he might be very close to where that might be, but there's some great memorabilia around. We might see if we can get some photos of some of that, put it up there as well, and make it a place that people can go to and maybe look at the history. Some of it controversial, some of it not. I have to talk to the real people to find out what actually happened. A lot of them passed away, unfortunately. But I'm sure amongst all that, there's some great knowledge to be had and to put up on that website so people can go and look at it. One of the things I just did want to mention, because I think I've got a little bit of time left here, is that just reading through this, Elsie Mead, who was the first person trained with a guide dog in Australia, and it was done in WA, and he got her dog Bo. I think it was, yeah, it was Bo. They actually, when Phyllis Gratian decided to start up the Lady Nell School, they thought that this was going to be a threat, a threat to guide dogs and they're trying to get their school started up in Victoria. So they flew Elsie over from Western Australia, and she did this tour of awareness and campaigns, I suppose, and just reading through, and she went to all the states. She did something like 25 TV interviews. She travelled for months and months and months, just to put out the word about what guide dogs were and all that. So there was a lot of people in the early stages, obviously, that travelled a lot, and it would have been really, really hard, this travel. Hard to imagine. 2 minutes, oh, fantastic. Okay. Well, I just use that 2 minutes. Have anybody got any questions that I probably won't be able to answer? No? Well, you'll hear a lot more from this. We've got people in this room that I'm sure are going to be on that page of honour, probably not for another 40 years or so, hopefully, but I certainly think that they will work. Back then, it'll probably be a virtual page of honour of some sort. It'll be a reality type thing. But we've got some great trainers in the room here, and I just want to say thank you to those who make themselves available for us today, and the fact that you've got big shoes to fill in regard to the people who have come before, and you already know that. So thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Keep your eye on the website. We'll get to build that as we get time to do it, but there should be something up there before Christmas. Thank you.
Okay, thanks Greg. It's great to know where the guide dog movement in Australia came from. It's fascinating reading. There is a lot of information out there, but we're happy to be able to start a historical page on the DGHA website, which will honour the people of the past and be a lasting tribute to them, and we'll be adding to it over the years. So thanks, Greg. And we're moving on to the present of dog guide mobility in Australia. Most of you would be aware that Sydney in September hosted the International Guide Dog Federation conference, which has had people from all around the world who are involved in the training of dogs and different organisations. And to talk about that conference and an overview of the sessions, topics of discussion, and any recommendations that come out of it about new ways of training dogs and training handlers, I'm very pleased to have Paul Adrian with us, who is Guide Dog Services Manager at Guide Dogs New South Wales ACT. He manages the breeding and training kennels in Sydney, and otherwise known as the Dog Father. I'd like to say thanks very much, Paul, for being here and being involved. Paul's been, I think, coming to DJJ conferences from our very first in Adelaide 4 years ago. So thanks very much, Paul.
Thanks, Rowena, and thank you very much for the invitation to attend yet another seminar. I commend the work of the committee and the DGHA in pulling this event together. I certainly know a little bit about the challenges of bringing a large seminar together after being heavily involved in the organisation of the IGDF seminar, and I'll come to that. But before I do that, I just want to suggest to everybody in the audience that taking a seat at the front here and making a presentation is a great thing to do, and I highly recommend it. And the reason I recommend it is, no matter what the subject that you've been given, once you have the microphone, you have a license to take it in any direction you so choose. What I wanted to do actually was pick up on some of the subject matter from Greg, because I'm a person who's not quite done yet. I'm not quite part of history, but I think history is a really interesting and valuable thing for us to be celebrating. And the champions of the industry are very important to us, and I really am a person who values that. And I'm going to connect some dots for you in a minute. So let me just tell you a little bit about, I'm going to skip over my favourite topic, which is my dog, to my second favourite topic, which is me. And you could be right. So, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the history, how I came into the industry, because it connects to some of the people that have just been mentioned. So this will probably take up the half hour, but we can talk about the IGDF seminar a little bit later, over lunch perhaps. When I was in my early 20s, I was a little bit of a lost soul in terms of looking for a career, but friends in Canberra had a Labrador dog and they wanted to go on holidays, and they asked me if I'd come to Canberra and dog sit for them, which I duly agreed to do. During that time, I took this said Labrador dog to the top of Black Mountain, and at the top of Black Mountain, I saw a rope. And that rope led me down a path, and that rope led me to a tree, and on that tree was a brass plaque with strange dots on it that meant nothing to me. But by the end of that walk, upon returning to the car park, I managed to connect the dots. And I realised that this was a walk for people with a vision impairment, and that the signs on the tree were describing what sort of tree they were. So that was the epiphany moment for me, the moment that I decided there was potentially a career here. I like dogs and I really enjoyed working with people, and I decided, I was aware there was such a thing as dog guide, so I decided that's the career I wanted. And I think when we talk about these legends of the industry, these two things are what brought most of us to the industry. We like dogs, but we love working with people, and we love the difference that our dogs can make in people's lives. Having decided that I wanted to join the industry, I proceeded to scan the newspaper, Saturday's Age, as it happens, which was about a metre thick at that stage. And that's what everybody looking for a job did, scan these masses and masses of classified ads. And lo and behold, an ad for a cadet came up. And it was with Phyllis Gratian, seeing eye docs in Kensington, not in Kensington at that stage, in Malvern. And I duly applied for that said cadetship, or traineeship, I can't remember what it was called, and received an interview. And off I went, and there I sat across the desk from Phyllis and had my interview and clearly made a major hack of it because I didn't hear again from Phyllis for many, many years. So I was a little bit disappointed. I was a little bit disappointed because I didn't get any feedback, be it good or bad, from the interview, and I gave up on that idea. Sometime later, another cadetship appeared in a newspaper, and a friend of mine actually told me about that, and they said, oh, there's another opportunity for you. And I said, no, I'm not going there. They're very rude. They won't even reply to my application. And they said, no, it's a different organisation. So I duly applied, and the person who interviewed me was, said, Eric Hatchley. And so I'm very, very proud of the fact that I met with Phyllis, I worked extensively with Eric, who influenced me then and continues to influence me today, but also other legends, one of whom was recognised at the last EGRHA seminar in the name of Ray Joyce, recently retired from Guide Dogs New South Wales, and also another name that I will mention, which will get me back to the seminar, which is the subject of my talk here today, and that is John Gosling. John Gosling is still working at Guide Dogs Victoria in a part-time capacity, but John was always a great promoter and great believer in guide dog mobility and a great promoter of and supporter of new schools as they develop around the world. Now, we heard a little bit about the development of guide dogs in Singapore, but there are still many, many parts of the world where guide dogs and guide dog services are only just becoming available. And John has always had a passion to support those schools. He works tirelessly in his own time to support those schools in his role with the Development Committee of the International Guide Dog Federation. Each 2 years at the International Guide Dog Federation conference, a person who has made outstanding contribution to the world of guide dogs generally, in particular to supporting the development of new schools around the world and supporting people meet the standards required of members of the IGDF, is recognised by the presentation of an award known as the Ken Lord Award. And this year at the seminar, John Gosling was recognised for his lifetime of service to the industry of guide dogs with the presentation of the Ken Lord Award. So I think we should all congratulate John for that. And so to the seminar itself. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about the detail because there's just so much. In total, there was three, five, six, 7 days of presentations. So I simply can't pricey them down into a 30-minute presentation. Although I'll try and pick out some highlights later, but just to tell you a little bit about what that looks like, what the seminar looks like to begin with. First of all, Guide Dogs New South Wales is the host organisation, and the seminar itself is owned by the International Guide Dog Federation. So schools that are interested in hosting the seminar put in bids. Every 2 years, they say they want to host a seminar and where it will be and put together all of the logistical stuff. But all of the programming and content is the responsibility and in the ownership of the International Guide Dog Federation itself. So the host organisation, in this case, Guide Dogs New South Wales ACT, does all of the hard work, but IGDF takes all of the glory. I really suggest that you look at the other options if this ever comes into your field. So the IGDF seminar is held every 2 years. It's a gathering of providers from all over the world. It's held every 2 years, as I said. This year was the first time it's been held in this hemisphere. And it's probably going to be many, many years before it returns to Australia or New Zealand, simply because of the reluctance and challenges of Europeans and North Americans to travel this far for a conference. On the other side, having the conference here in Australia for the first time was an incredible opportunity for staff from all of the agencies around Australia to have very, very high levels of representation. So normally, it's very difficult financially for organisations to send more than a few people to conferences that are held in France or the United States or Canada. But having the conference here in Sydney meant all of the Guide Dogs Australia members and the Seeing Eye Dog School were able to send really large numbers of delegates. And it's their opportunity to meet with other professionals from all over the world and get really excited about some of the innovations that they hear about. In total, we had 300 delegates from around the world representing 28 countries and 60 individual providers of guide dog services. So it's a pretty decent-sized conference. And despite the distance, the attendance was exactly where we were hoping to get it to. The average attendance is sort of 280 to 300, and we actually 292, I think, was the final count. In total, there were 35 presentations. Now, IGDF is made up of a number of different membership types, so I'll just tell you a little bit about that too. First of all, we have affiliate organisations. They're organisations that don't actually provide or train guide dogs, but might do something such as guide dog breeding. So an example would be the Minnesota Guide Dog Breeding Centre, which is just focused on breeding guide dogs for service dog providers. Then the second category of membership is an inquiring organisation. Now that's an organisation that at present doesn't have a service, but has some individuals who are interested in forming a group in order to further the aim of creating a service. The third level of membership is what's called an applicant. Applicants need to have already achieved one guide dog team in operation and have a reasonable business plan that will lead to a sustainable service that grows into the future. And the last category of membership is that of member. And member organisations, I think, have to have placed, I think it's 10 teams. I'd stand corrected on that, but it's I think it's around about 10. And each 5 years, they need to undertake an accreditation assessment where their standards are measured against some set criteria for their membership to be extended for a further 5 years. So that's the quality standards. Okie doke. In actual fact, this year there were four separate events. So we had the IGDF seminar. Prior to the IGDF seminar, CEDA down in Kensington hosted a veterinary symposium, which was attended by primarily veterinarians who are interested in the challenges of breeding and training, or breeding and the health problems that might be associated with working dogs. Then we had the IGDF seminar, which had the 300 delegates. Immediately after the IGDF seminar, we hosted a breeders workshop here in Sydney. Breeding is such a big part of the business of producing guide dogs that there's enough interest to warrant a separate seminar just on that particular topic. And I'll come back to that a little bit later when I look at some of the presentations. But that was hosted by Guide Dogs New South Wales. That was a Guide Dogs New South Wales initiative that we decided to hold because of the general interest. And we had 80 delegates to that. Following that, Guide Dogs Queensland hosted a beginner's breeders seminar, if you like, a breeder's seminar light for providers who may not be breeding as yet, but were interested in finding out some of the basics. So someone described it as seminar season, and it was pretty challenging and pretty tiring. But nonetheless, there's some really great work. So let me just get back to my notes and see where I'm up to. Okay, so in total, 35 presentations were made at the IGDF seminar. I'm going to focus on the IGDF seminar here, since that was the topic that was given to me. Although I will mention a further 32 presentations were made at the Breeders' Workshop. Here in Australia, you've got some pretty good providers. Some providers who are interested in the science of what they do, who are world leaders in many, many respects. And I think that's really worth celebrating, because in the context of size, dog guide providers in Australia are not big organisations. The schools here are providing, you know, somewhere between, in some cases, two up until 50 to 60 dog guides per year. There are organisations in the world that are providing 800 dogs per year to clients. So they're very, very large in comparison with the providers here. And yet, and I'll give you some statistics, of the 35 presentations made, 8 presentations at the IGDF seminar were from Guide Dogs Australia schools, and a further 3 of those of the presentations were made by staff from Vision, Seeing Eye Dogs Australia. So that's a total of 11 of the 35 presentations were from dog guide providers in your country. That's a sensational result, really. Nearly a third, and they're independently selected. I didn't select. I booked the hotel. I did all of that stuff. I did all the hard work there, but I didn't select the program. I didn't make the program. The IGDF committee, drawn from members outside of Australia, they put the program together. So I think that's something to be really proud of about our schools, that we were able to put together abstracts that were of such quality that they really dominated the program. And beyond that, a further 2 sessions were facilitated by Lil Deverell. Does anybody know Lil Deverell in the room? She's a... a few nods. Lil's a known instructor based in Melbourne with a very strong... Dr. Lil Deverell, I stand corrected. A very strong academic bent, who's doing some really interesting research, including a prior involvement with the Bionic Eye Project. So... she actually provided another 2 presentations of those 35, which I haven't actually counted. So, we can be very, very proud. So, in terms of the themes, there was no overarching theme for this conference, although sometimes there is an overarching theme. This time there wasn't, but I think there's a few things that came up that stood out to me. First of all was a fundraising stream, which was a bit of a new initiative. So often these conferences or seminars are focused on technical aspects of dog supply and working with the recipients of our dog guides. But in this case, there was a recognition and some really good papers on fundraising, which is always a challenge for our organisations. And I thought it was, you know, very interesting at this time, particularly in the Australian context, as we move towards a different way of funding many of our services through the NDIS. I won't comment further about that, other than there were some really interesting papers presented about sponsorship of guide dogs, which is one of the, has been a very successful way of raising funds for many schools, because people who donate, they really like to feel close to the service. They often don't like to just, you know, put money into the vacuum of a, of an organisation, but actually want to be attached to something tangible. And sponsoring a dog is something that many, many individuals and also corporate sponsors want to be involved in. The second really important theme, and I think John from Guide Dogs Victoria will be talking a little bit about some of the technology aspects later, but technology was huge. And some really, really big questions around the future of technology and its impact on guide dogs in the future are being discussed. And it's not a new topic of conversation, but will guide dogs be obsolete? That's that's so interesting, because it's a genuine question. We don't know where technology is going to lead us, but it's certainly going to have a huge impact on everybody in this room, and we hope it's the technology is enabling, as it appears that it's going to be. But whether or not it's going to make our wonderful guide dogs or dog guides obsolete in the near future, I very much doubt. But nonetheless, it's important for the providers of dog guide services to keep abreast of technology, to embrace it, and to ensure that it integrates within our current service offering, so that we're not competing with technology, we're utilising it in the best possible way. So I think that's a big topic of conversation in many of the organisations worldwide about technology, having technology arms, and what, if any, impact it will have on the provision of dog guides in the future. Positive reinforcement. Does everybody have a concept of positive reinforcement? Yeah. So, you know, it sort of swept us a wave over us, 10 years ago, and it's still a wave, it's still in motion, people learning about what positive reinforcement means, and providers all around the world adapting their training methods to be inclusive of this concept of positive reinforcement, which is very, very easily misunderstood too, and I'm not going to go into the technicalities of it, but it is having a really significant impact on the way we do business and the way we provide dog guides to our clients and the way we raise and train them. The fourth theme that really struck me was breeding and breeding and health. And these are fundamental challenges in developing a steady supply of dog guides. Now, having chatted to a few people in the room today about their applications for replacement or new dog guides in the future, I'm aware that many of you can be faced with significant wait times, and that can actually have a really significant impact on you. That's something that all guide dog providers they have it. It's top of mind. How do we develop a supply chain of dogs that are suited to your needs and available when you want them? So that is a really challenging thing for everybody. So there's a lot of emphasis in many conferences around breeding and health, and why there was so much interest in the breeding seminar which followed the IGDF seminar. How am I going for time, by the way?
5 minutes.
Oh, so let me return to Milo. because I'm really, really limited for time, how did that happen? I'll just return to and talk a little bit about breeding, because perhaps it's something that the production process, the dogs up until the point that you receive them, it's a bit of a vacuum of knowledge, isn't it? It's like, well, what happens back there? And I'm hoping to tell you some really exciting stuff in a later presentation. But let me tell you a little bit about what's happening in the breeding space, because the science of breeding, the way we're going to breed dogs in the future, is just so different from the way we were going to do it, or the way we did it in the past, by picking what we thought was a nice dog and mating it with another what we thought was a nice dog. The future is going to be so different. The future is actually now. So this is a topic that I'm really inadequate in addressing, and it really demands, and I suggest at the next seminar you get somebody professional in to talk about this. But I'm going to paint a very, very, without going to the papers, I'm just going to introduce a concept. Does anybody know what ever heard the concept estimated breeding value? Okay, so in the cattle industry, in the dairy industry, in the pork industry, in all of those productive industries that are putting meals on our plate, they use these things called estimated breeding values. So what that means is that if I, for instance, with a dairy herd, if I continue to select cows that produce the most milk and breed with those, I'm going to breed cattle that produce more milk. That's good economically. If I select pigs that grow quickly and fatten quickly, I'm going to be able to get those pigs to market more quickly or have more meat to sell from the same amount of work. So it's all less economic imperative. But estimated breeding values can be used to... So they're very, very simple EBVs. Estimated breeding values in the future will be able to be used in guide dogs to measure the heritability of not just health characteristics, but behavioural characteristics. So there are enormous number that we could measure, but something that most of you would be aware of, this characteristic that we call potential dog distraction, how distractible or reactive your dog is in the presence of other dogs, it may or may not have a heritable characteristic. If we can develop data sets, and we are, that we can then measure, then through mathematical formulas, we can determine whether or not that characteristic is going to be heritable by the next generation of dogs. And further beyond that, we then move into this area called genomics. And that is where they drill down from that high-level understanding of, well, is this heritable? And then through DNA analysis, find out which genes or multiple genes or locusts this behaviour is stemming from. And so therefore, rather than selecting on the basis of what we see, we may be able to in the future select dogs on the basis of their DNA by sampling. And that means knowing whether a dog might be suitable from a simple saliva test when it's born. Or knowing whether a dog is going to be more successful in our breeding program may be able to be tested by a simple saliva test at the point of being born.
2 minutes.
That's okay, Rowena, I'm nearly done. So I think that's, that is such an exciting prospect for the future. It's going to have an impact across all manner of things in terms of the way we live our lives, but it's already happening in the world of dog guides. It's happening because we are now collecting similar behavioural data in schools all over the world. So we're not all doing our own thing. We're collecting the same data in the same way. So that was one of the significant papers at the conference. And a second really, really significant paper at the conference was the development of an international database, which has been developed, where we're all putting our similar data in, so that when we're looking at our dogs, bred at Guide Dogs New South Wales, we can look at the thousands of dogs that are related to that dog from all parts of the globe. So that big data is available to us to make even better selections. And the third really important paper, which was delivered by a woman by the name of Eleanor Carlson, and just to give her her dues, Assistant Professor, University of Massachusetts Medical School and the Broad Institute of Harvard and MIT. This is a heavy hitter in the academic world. This is a smart woman and a great speaker, I would add too. But she's looking at the genomics. She's looking at this data that's coming from all over the world and looking at how that might link to genetics and genetic testing. So there, in terms of international collaboration around breeding and improving the quality of our dogs from a health perspective and from a suitability perspective, there is some really, really, really big big names involved. All of the big schools are involved, and we're all sharing that data to improve the future and to ensure the future of our dog supplies into the future. Okay. So no time left to...
Just a call for questions. Just time for a couple of questions if anyone has them. Anyone? Are they ready? Just wait for a microphone. Sorry, can Beck or somebody come and get the other microphone?
Done, Beck.
Hi, Paul, it's Penny. Just wondering about handler voices at the IGDF. I understand that it's... I'm not sure, could an organisation like DGHA apply for affiliate membership? Do handlers get a voice about how the things that are going on at schools actually play out in the real world?
Can of worms.
That's a great question, Penny, and I appreciate it. I think when I was talking about the IGDF and the membership requirements, to answer the first part of that question, was affiliate members have to be doing something that's related to the provision of dog guides, but not necessarily training or providing them to people. So whether there is an avenue for membership through that process, I'm not here to represent the IGDF. I'm not able to answer that question, but it's certainly a question for the IGDF and the voice of consumers. The only avenue that would be open is through affiliate membership, but affiliate membership does exist. So that would be the way that I would approach it if I was to want to further that conversation. To the second part, most dog guide providers, if not all dog guide providers today, are more and more seeking to provide better feedback mechanisms for the consumers of the product. And that's something that is going to continue in the future and I'd have no doubt, will become more and more important in the way that we design and provide the services that we do. We're moving, and I think, you know, with the advent of the NDIS, it's inevitable that we're moving to an environment where the consumer voice is going to be the strongest voice. And I think that can only be good, because if I look back at the way that we operated 20 or 30 years ago, it was a lot more regimented and structured and organisational focused than it is today. But it's it's something that organisations have to continue to work on if we're going to remain relevant to the needs of our consumers. And if we don't, then other organisations will appear that appeal more to the consumers. And if we're not willing to change... and if I could just tie that back to my original comments, is that while I was very, very keen to say how much I value our connection with history, we actually have to approach the future with a very, very different mindset than dragging the past with us. The past is to be celebrated, but the future is to be embraced.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks, Penny, for that question, because that would have been mine. So on behalf of DJHA, thanks, Paul, very much for your... So on to the future of dog guide mobility. I'm really, you know, a passionate believer that I don't think technology into the future will ever replace a living, breathing, furry friend. My dog is more of a constant companion than my husband, and sorry, because my husband's in the room. To me, I just love working with a living, breathing creature and being part of that team. But interesting that, you know, the IGDF was looking at technology into the future, because, as we know, it's all made a huge impact in our lives, and it really will impact dog guide mobility into the future. So I've been doing a little bit of research into the robotic guide dog, or dog guide, which many of you may have heard of. There's been some interesting leaps and bounds in recent years. My family are helping me to present this. So my sister Vicky will be audio describing a YouTube video, and we don't have a projector screen in the room. So that for those of you that can see in the room, after this session, you can come up and have a look at the video if you're interested to see it. And I will email out the link to the YouTube video if any of you would be interested in watching it after the event. Vicky will be describing the video, the action in the video, and then we'll be showing the video. And it is a lot of Japanese language, and it's subtitled. So Vicky will be reading the subtitles of that video. And then my brother Randall will be reading the research that we have done into robotic guide dogs, and we'll take questions and comments after that. So thank you to my family for taking over the presentation of the dog guide mobility in the future.
Okay, technically.
It's on. It's good to go.
Just testing. Unlike Paul, who sat here and thought, a captive audience, I sat here and thought from my background, which is education, what a... Is that better?
Yeah.
How's that?
Better.
I won't repeat the captive audience comment.
Please don't.
I sat here from my education background and thought, what a still audience. All those white and black bottoms underneath the table. It's a credit to you handlers and a credit to you trainers. Well done. Mm-hmm. I have never spoken or sat in front of such a still, attentive audience.
Except for that end over there.
Well, yeah, I have to admit, I would stand normally near that group over there. Beck, I'm sorry, I think we need you again. This video that you're going to hear and see shows a man walking with a robotic dog. I'll read the English subtitles for the Japanese commentator at a speed that really is beyond understanding, but I'll do my very best. If I stumble, I apologise. Firstly, I'll begin with a brief description of the visual aspect of the video. The robotic dog is made of metal, black metal, and slightly taller than an average Labrador. It has a very ugly, beg your pardon to the manufacturers, but I'm being honest here, it has a very ugly cube-shaped body with a vertical pole as a neck and a mobile phone-sized screen as a head at around about man's waist height. It has four jointed legs that are permanently bent to enable it to walk up and down steps. It has wheels for feet and rolls along on flat ground. For the dog to turn 180 degrees on the flat floor, the man turns the handle to manipulate the dog into a 3 or a 4 point turn. The robotic dog is on the right-hand side of the man, who is holding a hand grip at the top of a vertical pole attached to the left-hand side of the dog. The man's arm remains slightly bent. The robotic dog moves very slowly, using one foot after the other type action to walk up and down the steps. On the flat, the robotic dog rolls on its wheels with its four bent legs held rigid. The man and machine walk up two steps to a narrow landing. They walk down two steps on the opposite side of the landing and turn 180 degrees to walk back up the two steps and down the two steps on the other side. This action takes the duration of the spoken commentary. I thought that was important for you to understand how very slowly this machine works. Okay, we're ready to roll.
We're
going to
play the sound over here.
You're going to play the sound over, are you?
It should go through the speaker.
Yeah. Oh, awesome.
Okay. Just skip the Google ad. Okay.
NSK has developed a four-legged robot with wheels and are working towards the creation of a robotic guide dog. The robot has a handle with a variable angle and length, so the user can maintain a stable posture and consistent grip at all times, even when being guided downstairs. To recognize steps, the robot processes images from a sensor. The sensor data is converted into shape, position, and attitude information in 3D space. This enables the robot to recognize the number of steps and their width. It also makes recognition possible even while going upstairs, which was difficult before. From now on, NSK plans to do field tests on safety with a view to releasing a commercial version.
Sorry for those of you that we couldn't read the subtitles over that, but I will share the link with people. And for those of you that use speech on your phone or tablets or computers, it does actually read the subtitles in English. So, but basically, we'll go on to the second part of this session presentation, which is some research that's been done into the robotic dog, and that actually covers most of what was said in Japanese in the video. But yes, if you watch the video with your speech turned on, it will read the English subtitles for you. So thank you, Victoria, and thank you, Randall.
Okay, thank you, Rowena. Randall's my name. I'm Rowena's twin brother. My background's actually in engineering and particularly advanced control systems. So whilst I'm reading Rowena's research, I actually do have a bit of a background in some of the information that's going to be read out. I'd also have to concur with Rowena, even though she's my twin sister, I would say from a technical point of view, my most recent background's in power stations. We have many, many thousands of sensors to automate the generation of power within a power station, but still the most important part of that, of any system, is actually the people. And I would suggest that for efficient use of mobility, dogs and people with dogs will actually outstrip the performance of pretty much any automation. This has been my experience to date. And I would have to concur with Rowena that it's unlikely that the robotic dog I just saw on the screen there will be able to replace our canine friends anytime soon. So, without further ado, the early research and the prototype of robotic dog guides was carried out in the UK, which developed a robotic guide built around the frame of a wheelchair. Preliminary research and development was also conducted in Melbourne University in Australia. To date, the most promising research and development of a robotic dog guide has come from NSK, a Japanese electronics company, which has collaborated with the University of Electrocommunications since 2009 on a series of dog guide robots. Earlier versions look like a futuristic trash can on wheels, a kind of real-life R2-D2 droid. 2 years later, however, NSK debuted the NR3, which looked less like a droid and is far more technologically advanced, although still black, still steel. Like its canine counterpart, the NR3 has 4 robotic legs, with each leg containing a set of wheels on which it actually moves. Amazingly, each leg is capable of moving, allowing the robot to climb stairs when needed. Its single eye consists of Microsoft kinetic sensors that help it identify and navigate obstacles and stairs. The NR3 also has paws on its legs that contain bumper sensors that also help it avoid obstacles. And like a real guide dog, the NR3 has voice recognition. It can receive verbal instructions from users and, unlike a real dog, responds back in words. The Japanese manufacturer is working on a new mechanised canine that could one day serve as a guide dog for the blind. The company's latest prototype builds on the work of the University of Electrocommunications, which unveils its first model, the NR01, in 2005, followed by an updated version, NR02, in 2007. With its third version, the NSK and UEC have added a Microsoft kinetic sensor which allows it to more easily identify and navigate obstacles or stairs. A quadrupedal beast can also scamper up and down steps with more grace than its predecessors, which moves more like arthropods than actual dogs. The bot's paws have also been equipped with obstacle-avoiding bumper sensors, and researchers are working on incorporating voice commands as well. NSK says its guide dog could eventually feature GPS capabilities to provide more accurate directions for the blind and vision impaired, though it probably will be quite some time before it hits the pavement. The company hopes to commercialise the dog bot by 2020. The four-legged, eight-wheeled mechanical companion rolls on flat surfaces and can even tackle stairs. It employs attitude, shape, position data, and from an innovative hack of Microsoft Kinetic gaming devices, sensors, stairs, number, and width. Sagayama, the designer, pointed out that there are sensors on the legs as well. If we put a sensor on the head, the bot can also see what's ahead, but it has blind spots around the legs. So the distance image sensor on the head is used to recognise steps overall, whilst information around the legs is obtained to use local proximity. To keep the user's grip solid and prevent the need to hunch over on stairs, the handle varies in height and angle. An intuitive force sensor on the end of the grip detects the robot's movement, push forward and it moves straight ahead, twist it and the robot turns. The robot dog speaks with a computerised female voice with which it conveys details about the surroundings, as well as instructions to the user on how to avoid obstacles. It will eventually respond to voice commands. A function will make it even more similar to the real dogs it's designed to potentially replace. While the rather noisy prototype is well thought out, there are still many design and safety issues to be solved before a commercial version, still many years away, will be ready for the market. Thank you.
That's awesome.
So, can I ask a question?
Yep.
What do they think the market...
need a microphone.
Thanks. It's Annette here. I'm just wondering, have they done any market research and what did they find with their market research on robotic dogs?
Is this on?
Yeah. Yes.
Annette, I don't know. Sorry. But... we'll do some further research and come back to you on that one.
Actually, I can answer a little bit.
Oh, sorry, I'll just hand to Randall who can answer that.
I can't tell you about any current research, but when I used to frequent Toshiba in Japan about 15 years ago, I was introduced to a robot that shook my hand, and that was about as far as it went. There was also a robot voice recognition in the lifts, and it was quite tricky to get to the right floor, especially when I was speaking English and in a Japanese country. So whilst that's a little bit of old news, it's probably developed a lot since then, it does demonstrate to you that whilst technology is very enabling, it's usually adaptive, it's not always to replace. So I would suggest that the development is quite some years away, and that's probably more helpful for helping in certain circumstances, but not probably a replacement technology.
Thank you.
Hi, it's Chris here. Two comments I would have to make on both of those. One is, one of my concerns is that they would be getting halfway across George Street in Sydney or the equivalent in Melbourne, and either the battery runs out or... the chip completely fries.
I've got to again say, this is not on behalf of Rowena, but how many times does your mobile phone battery run out?
Yeah,
quite sufficient.
No. Electric cars don't have the capacity to get the distance of petrol cars. Mm. And
yet.
Yes.
The word is yet, always. We struggle.
Without a microphone, we can't.
Yeah. Can you just wait for a microphone? Just raise your hand if you want to say something or wait for the microphone.
Okay. I remember these arguments with every technological research, every technological advance. We can take it back to the horse and buggy. The fact is, technology changes. It is a logarithmic progression. The fact also is, we do not have the ability to comprehend that which we cannot see and experience. So it is a while away. However, there are a new product just released, the Sonoband, that gives you small vibrations on your arm that tell you where things are. Earlier technology, fairly inexpensive, was a ring that did something similar in the third world, that gave several blind people, that gave significant numbers of blind people more independence. Dogs are very, and I have a dog and I love having guide dogs, dogs are very adaptable. the technology for this sort of product is also being developed. You've got your neural nets going on. You now have your, I was looking at home automation for decades, and now I've got it set up in my home quite easily using Wi-Fi, Google Home, iPhone Siri, and Alexa. I'm using all three, comparing them. Things change, things adapt. It's very difficult to take what we know and speculate into the future without being very cynical. But the fact is, things do adapt and they do change.
Indeed.
Hi, how are you? One of the problems with technology, we always leave our deafblind people. So as someone who can't hear and someone who can't see, using a robot is not something that we can see achievable for us. So that's still an issue for us. And that's something that is concerning. You know, if I don't look after my dog anymore, if I try for a robot, it's going to take a long time to find a robot that is a good fit for a deafblind customer.
Can I have a microphone?
Yeah, thanks for those comments. I'd probably just like to wrap up by saying, when I get my assessment from my new dog, I would like one that has an inbuilt GPS and can talk back to me. That would be really wonderful, thank you. I love my little furry girl, and I just cannot imagine walking with a dog, even a robotic dog, even if it's walked up to my speed. You know, I think it's a long way off, but really amazing stuff. Any final questions or comments?
Yeah, Rowena, it's Nadia. Firstly, no, just no.
Yeah.
That is all. I'm going to be one of those old grumpy people that does not embrace technology in this sense. I just couldn't do it. The positives that Rowena just mentioned, yep, but I can get them in another way. And the other positive is at least then I wouldn't have to pick up after my dog. But even with all of those positives, for me personally, it doesn't outweigh what my dog does, who my dog is, and how she contributes to my life. So no, definitely not. And I don't know if anyone else heard, as a side comment, there were a number of dogs groaning. So I think there may be a therapy session for our dogs in the afternoon.
I'm just going to throw another little issue into the mix. It's Paul, and that is, all of us enjoy unique relationships with our dogs. And in a talk about robotics, we're often focused on the functional nature of the robotics and whether that would suit us. First of all, a younger generation is growing up with technology, and their comfort with technology will be different. And secondly, and this is possibly a slightly scary thing, and I'm again very unqualified to talk about it, but it's the advent of AI, artificial intelligence, where the difference between a living being and a machine is starting to be narrowed.
Yeah.
As machines can respond and learn and potentially react to us in ways that might elicit the emotional responses that our dogs bring to us. And that is both a scary thing in terms of how the world might look like in 50 years, but also a potentially fabulous thing if you think about elderly people, potentially in nursing homes, who might get the value of pet ownership through a robotic dog or robotic pet of some sort that can elicit those same emotional responses. And there's already strong evidence that people can have emotional responses to machines and robots and so on. So add this element of AI and better robotic technique, it's going to be a very, very, very interesting future.
Do you want
Yeah, thanks, Paul. Thanks, everyone. On behalf of DJHA, I'd like to say thank you to Greg, Paul, and to Victoria and Randall for the interesting session, and I look forward to, you know, just seeing the way technology will take us. So, yeah, thank you to our presenters.
This has been a Dog Guide Handlers Australia audio presentation. If you would like further information on Dog Guide Handlers Australia or like to listen to further audio, please go to our website www.dgha.org.au. Thank you. Do you always have to have the last word?